Hello, everybody, and welcome to The Weed Wonks, the podcast that dives deep into the nerdy details, the minutiae, the ever-fun silliness that is cannabis regulatory policy. And we do it all to help our fellow policy wonks, policymakers, regulators, business members, advocates, and the canna curious stay more informed about the ever-changing landscape of cannabis laws and regulations. Please remember to rate, subscribe, and review. I'm your host, Jordan Wellington, managing partner of VS Strategies. We want to give special thanks to our sponsors, Rootworks, for helping us get this podcast off the ground. And as always, to our producer, Josh, who is just incredible. We have a really cool show today, one that I'm very excited about, where we're going to dive into one of my favorite cannabis markets to think about, to learn about, to talk about, to learn from. And that is the great state of Nevada. We had a good time in Nevada. That was one of my most important Nevada lessons early on in my Nevada-related career. And to help us learn about all the amazing things going on in the great state of Nevada, we have the executive director of the Nevada Cannabis Compliance Board, Tyler Klimas. Welcome to the show, Tyler. We're super happy to have you here and really appreciate you taking the time to chat with us today.
Jordan, thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Yeah. And so I love talking about what's going on in Nevada. I think you guys have done one of the better jobs across the country in terms of developing a good regulatory program. And we want to talk about kind of all the different experiences that sets you guys up for success and some of the cool things going on in the market. But as always, we want to start in the same place, which is kind of how you got into your role, what your background is, because that informs your perspective on policy and all the great things that we can all learn from each other and what you bring to the table, adding to and facilitating the conversation of improving cannabis policy over time.
Sure. Well, thanks, Jordan. And yeah, pretty eclectic background on the way to this position. You know, I started my career working for former Nevada Governor Brian Sandoval. I worked his campaign and joined his administration back in 2010. And, you know, I think if you work in a governor's office, you know, you end up kind of being a utility player, right? All these offices are understaffed and you get exposed to a lot of different things, which is great for development. And, you know, I managed his cabinet, worked legislative sessions. I was his press secretary for a while, and then also did some outside assignments. One of the last assignments that I did was Governor Sandoval was one of the first Republican or the first Republican governor to expand Medicaid back in the Affordable Care Act days, which I'm sure you remember. And we stood up a state-based exchange, and it ended up failing miserably in that first year. A lot of it had to do with technology and back end. And so I went over there to do crisis communications and try to do a new marketing campaign that would regain public confidence and trust. And I think that is relevant here. And it was formative for me because it was the first kind of experience I had really understanding what public confidence and trust meant, public confidence and trust in government and function in whatever it is that a member of the public is trying to accomplish or get. And I think it certainly served me well when I came here to work in cannabis, because public confidence and trust in any regulated industry is certainly a core component.
So just for a second, though, I think that's such an interesting point that you're making. And I really want to highlight it for folks, because I think it's something that as policy people, we sometimes take for granted, that the public will have trust and confidence in the system, that the regulated entities will have trust and confidence in the system, that the regulator will have trust and confidence in the system. And so sometimes when we look at things that are good or bad or mistakes or problems or errors or kind of, hey, that wasn't a great policy idea, it turns out that was a mistake, we don't necessarily, we think about the potential like concrete negative outcomes that occur, but we don't always think about the erosion of trust. Right. The problem with a bad rule is not just that it's inefficient or it takes government resources away from something that would be more important to protect public health and safety. It erodes trust and confidence in the entire system by the regulators, by the regulatee, and by the public. And that actually erodes compliance rates on all factors. And that is actually leads to more inefficiency because regulators are spending policing things like that. So I think hammering home on that idea of like public trust being important, I think it's really awesome that you're bringing that up, because that's something that we don't think about enough, I think, a lot of the time. And having that mindset and understanding the importance of that is a huge value add to creating a strong regulatory agency.
No, you're absolutely right. And then when you talk about the eroding of public confidence and trust, I mean, that undermines everything that you try to do. And then on the opposite end, regaining that public confidence and trust, I mean, once you lose it, it's just so extremely difficult to get it back, right? You have to start at square one. You have to just be totally transparent and accountable. And it's such a slow process to regain it once you've lost it. You know, it's everything. You've got to protect it. And cannabis, you know, it's why we deposit money in a bank, right? And we're confident that it'll be there the next day, right? You have to have that. And cannabis is no different. This is a privileged, regulated marketplace. And so that has to be a core component. It's got to be something that regulators and everybody, even members of the industry, right? It's a mutual benefit to ensure that everybody has confidence and trust in what's going on, including, frankly, the federal government, maybe less so now, but certainly in the beginning, right, when we had worries that the feds may, you know, take some action or shut some states down, right? That confidence and trust is all part of that.
Yeah, I mean, I think about, actually, it's actually one of the biggest kind of like tail end harms of the drug war, right? Like, you know, you grew up when I grew up, and you grew up with DARE ads on TV, and you were kind of told in school that, like, if you consume cannabis, you're going to be a failure in life and a zombie, and it's going to make you stupid and all these other things. And then you like either try cannabis and it turns out it's not the devil, or you know people that are trying it and it turns out it's not the devil. You're like, well, wait a minute. That was bullshit. And then it becomes a question of, well, what else have you told me that that's not true? Right. And so that public trust and confidence is just so important, because it's like a cancer. It metastasizes throughout the entire system. And you have this one siloed area where you do erode public trust and confidence, but it metastasizes. It goes everywhere throughout the entire confidence of the system. And so public trust and confidence is key. But what that requires is obviously good governance to maintain, build, and kind of add on to the public trust. It's something you've got to maintain. It's a tree that needs to be watered and nurtured. So governor's office, public trust campaign, fascinating conversations about, I think what I would just say is Republicans are not a monolith, and Nevada Republicans are different than other Republicans. And you went through a really cool process at a Republican administration to implement healthcare policy. And you learned a lot about both being a jack of all trades, a very important thing to learn about as an executive director, because you have to touch everything, but also this idea of public trust. What was next after that?
So, you know, learned so much about health insurance that I wanted to get as far away from it as possible. And so moved to Washington, D.C. I ended up joining a small government affairs firm, a boutique firm in Washington, D.C., District Strategies. They had a small number of public and private sector clients, but they also had the state of Nevada as one of their bigger contracts. So I was able to go there and still work on state issues. But also, I mean, the experience of seeing what policy movement was like at the federal level as compared to the state level was extremely important to me. And I got a ton of experience, exactly what I was after, but just realizing how different that is, right? And at the state level, how fast you can move. And one of the biggest distinctions are like, what are wins, right? At the state level, when you're pushing policy and you're advocating, and what's a win at the federal level? They're very, very different, right? State, you can make policy changes, statutory changes in days and weeks and months is how long it takes. The federal level, it's completely different. It's the long game, right? There's higher stakes. It takes a lot of groundwork. It takes a lot of relationship building. And so learning about that distinction, being involved, getting my hands in that distinction was helpful. And it's helped me today, and certainly relates to some of the cannabis policy issues that we're dealing with out there. You know, and through that work, I was able to work with a lot of the nation's governors through like National Governors Association. And, you know, we worked on gaming compacts between states, which, again, we may see some of that come up in cannabis world on compacts. And then, you know, outside of that, a lot of coalition building on manufacturing and sourcing, and then a considerable amount of work on appropriations. So it was great to be in D.C., get that experience on Capitol Hill. And it's certainly served me right here.
Yeah. And so when we look at that stuff, right, you talk about like years. Colorado's celebrating 10 years of adult use legalized cannabis, and Congress is still, well, we're still deciding even what they didn't jack up in the farm bill and what all of that means. But putting that aside, at least the headline is we're still waiting for them to get their act together. We now have 24 states while we're recording this that have moved into a fully legalized adult use environment. And on a recent episode, we talked about the like absolute hilarity of the situation with hemp, where in Minnesota, using that as an example, you can purchase a THC derived hemp beverage with 5 milligrams of THC. You know, the only thing is that that plant had less than 0.3% THC dry weight by volume once several weeks when you tested it before harvest. And you can take that beverage and drive into Wisconsin and it's totally cool. But if you extracted that same molecule from a plant that had more than 0.3% THC, then you're a criminal that needs to be put into a cage. And like that, the level of stupidity of what I just said is the current federal policy, right? So we you know, it takes a long time for things to move in Congress and at the federal level, regardless of whether it makes any sense or not, right? It is just by design a very slow moving body. And I think years or even decades to get things changed. Whereas at the state level, absolutely, if you want to change something at the state level, it's just it's just so much easier and so much faster to get it done that it's educational. So the other part that I thought would be really interesting to talk about for a second is what you do have is a situation where I think when you're inside the government, sometimes you get a very myopic perspective on reality. I think if you're only in the private sector, that can happen too. You've had the unique opportunity to kind of be on both sides, if you will. And I think that that can really help when you start thinking about policy issues and when you start thinking about how things are going to play out. Because what I find sometimes is when folks have been in government their whole career, they don't always necessarily think through how is this going to play out in the private sector because the structure and incentives are totally different. And so do you feel like, you know, not just experience in procurement, experience in interstate compact, like the technical stuff, but just the idea of being on both sides of the aisle, sometimes that's like attacked as a bad thing. But in my opinion, it's actually a very good thing because it gives you perspective. And perspective is the key to good policymaking.
Sure. And I think a lot of times policy that's pushed, I mean, the intentions are good, right, Jordan? But then once it's actually implemented and the realities sometimes are very different. And I think having that perspective when you're going into it, and we'll probably talk more about it when we talk about consumption lounges and the process we did to promulgate those regulations. Again, where you start out is not necessarily where you should end. And a lot of that is gathering stakeholder input. Sure. But just always having it in the back of your mind, whether it is just like, hey, we're going to be prepared to make tweaks on day one, right? That may be even approach, but you've got to understand the implementations and the reality of what you push, regardless of how well-intentioned it was, are going to be different. And you have to watch out for it. And you try to capture that as much as you can on the front end, but you're not going to be able to. And you know, at the federal level, you know, pushing policy is one thing, but just fixing holes, right? And you just talked about it with the farm bill like that. I mean, just to be able to fix a problem and how long that takes is so different, you know, when you compare, you know, state level politics to federal politics.
Yeah, it feels like it's just a little bit easier, maybe a lot easier at the state level to be like, okay, guys, but right now we just need to roll up our sleeves and get something done, right? And like, we're going to work across the aisle, we're going to do all of these things. And it feels like that the politics, the Yankees and Red Sox, if you will, of the push and pull between Democrats and Republicans has a much stronger impact on public policy making at the federal level than it does at the state level. But that also may be because I'm from Colorado and it's not necessarily the same, I think, in other states. I think we were joking about how, you know, in Colorado, the minority has a better chance of getting their bills through than in some other states where, you know, if you're in the minority party, everything you want to do is just DOA no matter what. Whereas, you know, Colorado maybe that's influencing my opinion on that stuff to some extent. But I think it's probably true in Nevada too. You guys seem to be a little bit more on the sensible side.
Yeah, no, we're definitely a purple state, and you know, we have very accessible legislators, and so yeah, we're very much the same.
So, did you come from the boutique shop in DC to the cannabis board, or was there another stop in between?
No, so I ended up taking over that firm and finished out Sandoval's term as the holder of the state contract. And then Governor Sisolak took over, Democrat, took over after Sandoval was termed out. And so I continued lobbying on behalf of his office, and we got close. And at the same time, and I was following it pretty closely, there was some federal intersection there following cannabis in the state of Nevada, you know, and in the 2018 and 2019 timeframe, our marketplace started to go through some pretty difficult times. You know, we legalized adult use in 2017 out of a voter initiative in 16. And so it launched in 17. By 18, we had the first competitive licensing round. So, right, it was the first time that we had winners and losers. And, you know, when you have winners and losers, you have litigation, right? And that's not something, you know, that's most states have seen that. We've seen that happen over and over again. And in Nevada, you know, it was pretty significant. A lot of accusations on different sides, a lot of accusations of corruption, under the table dealings, favoritism. They dubbed it World War Weed, which is a cute name, but not something that you want to be, you know, known for.
Just because it's funny doesn't mean you want to carry the moniker.
Yeah. And I'm sure you'd ask the governor at the time, that's not, you know, exactly what they wanted to hear a lot. So in 19, while I was lobbying for the governor's office in the state and in D.C., they during that session, they created what would be the third iteration of oversight for the cannabis marketplace in Nevada. And they created the Nevada Cannabis Compliance Board. Luckily, you know, in Nevada, we had a blueprint in our backyard with the Nevada Gaming Control Board and the Nevada Gaming Commission, which is, you know, internationally renowned as a top regulatory body. So it was easy for the legislature and the governor at the time to look to that as a model. And actually, our public policy that's in statute for the Cannabis Compliance Board almost mirrors, it's almost identical to the public policy that exists for gaming. And that is, you know, integrity, accountability, moral character of individuals in it, and also just very strict regulation, right? And we've come a long way from that, but you understand why at the beginning that was the approach they took with all the issues that were going on. And so that's kind of the genesis of this board. You know, towards the end of that year, the governor asked, and my wife and I were looking to make a change from the district, and the governor asked if we would like to come and be the first executive director and try to organize and stand up the agency and launch it in 2020. So, you know, obviously a tremendous opportunity. You don't get many chances to kind of build something from scratch. And again, I relate it to some of my past experience. It was going to be, you know, there was no question on what the atmosphere was like and the volatility that was happening. Our backs would be against the wall on day one. It would be a huge challenge, but that was what was attractive about it. And so all of those pathways kind of led me to accepting that and coming out at the end of 2019 to try to stand up this body.
Yeah, and I definitely want to get into that, but there was something you brought up about, like, kind of the very strict initial approach that had been taken that I think is true. But there was one piece of Nevada policy that I couldn't not mention, which is that I always loved, was how you handled noncompliance at the get-go, right? And one of the things I saw, at least in the regulations, I wasn't there day to day, I'm sure complications in practice always exist, but there was this idea that an inspector would come out to a facility, they would identify a list of problems, they would then give that list to the licensee and say, you better fix all this stuff. I'm going to be back in 2 weeks. And then if you fix all of it in 2 weeks, obviously, if you're like selling to kids or doing something really bad, like that's different. But if it's just kind of administrative stuff, it's going to go away, right? We told you it was a problem. We came back in 2 weeks. We fixed it. And it was like written into the rules this way, right? And I remember first reading that. And in the early days in Colorado, and to some extent still today, the Colorado regulatory agency will come into your facility. They will identify a list of problems. They will not necessarily even share that list with you. And then they might come back later to tell you to fix it. There's not great communication on that stuff. And then if you ever do anything wrong, if they would give you an order to show cause, kind of the charging document, if you will, of all of your problems, you'll see inspections from years and years and years ago, at least at the time. I've not done this work in half a decade, so I'm sure things are different now. But I would deal with, and I would get this thing, and I would be like, okay, there's this like triggering event for a compliance issue, but your entire back history of like, ah, you know, we showed up 3 years ago and your battery backup wasn't working right. And we showed up 2 years ago and you had a camera facing the wrong direction. And it's just like, can we not be so petty? Can we not be so nitpicky? Talk about erosion of confidence and trust. That's the kind of thing that just pisses people off. And they're like, okay, cool. I did this one thing wrong, but like, why are you dredging up nitpicky stuff from a while ago? And I always felt that that process of the way that it was articulated in the rules led to collaborative problem solving, right? We are not here. We are not here to whip you with a stick like an angry teacher 200 years ago. We're here to come out and say, hey, these five things you're doing, they're not compliant and you need to fix them. But our goal is to get you into compliance, not to play cops and robbers. And even early on, I always felt like that was a strong ethos. Maybe didn't. And maybe that lends into some of the stuff that you were trying to bring of this, like, we're here to solve problems together. We're here to work together. The regulator and regulatee are an inherent relationship where we need to work together to make things better.
Yeah, and I agree with you. And I think that's ultimately going to lead you to success and lead to a successful partnership, which, by the way, a partnership between regulators and the industry is a core component of effective regulation, right? You don't have to be best buds, but you have to develop a partnership together. Now for us, and I'll talk a little bit about what we utilize now. I mean, you're right. We call them statement of deficiencies. We always utilize them. Now, when we took over, though, again, you have to understand the atmosphere was not good. And so we had a lot of cleanup. There was a lot of cleanup from the past iteration or past oversight body that we had to do. We also, again, when I talk about public perception and trust, that was gone. No doubt, without a doubt, we came out pretty aggressive, right? Trying to go after those that were really skirting the system and doing potentially criminal things. But I mean, we had to do that. I mean, that was what we were asked to do, but also something that was very necessary to bring it back to even keel. And so, yeah, outside of the core components, and you mentioned them, Jordan, obviously minors and selling to minors, diversion, any kind of criminal elements and, you know, letting any product go outside of the state lines are non-negotiables, right? As they should, as we're all trying to protect the marketplaces that we're working hard on. However, you know, something that we do now, we realize that we need to insert even, you know, another level of education that may help us. And so we'll go back now. Not only you received your statement of deficiencies, and yes, you have the ability to correct those, and it's very clear, but we'll also send you like a letter of concern now, which I think has been extremely effective, something we implemented, which is like, hey, listen, I mean, yeah, you had this list of deficiencies. They were, you know, potentially medium to large size deficiencies, but you've been a good operator. You have a long history of compliance. So guess what? This is just a recognition that it exists, right? We're not going to file a complaint. The case, for all intents and purposes, is closed. But we want you to know that, like, you know, you need to work on this. And that allowed us, A, to do our job, right? To make sure that we were working towards a compliant industry, but also saving our resources, our legal counsel, for those really, you know, extreme issues that we're starting to see less and less of. So I'm seeing much more letters of concern, statement of deficiencies being resolved, and a lot less complaints over the last 12, 24 months, which is, I think, a good remark. And by the way, that is kudos to the regulators, but also kudos to the industry as well, realizing that, again, the mutual benefit of everybody working to be in compliance. And so we're not having these kinds of issues and these discussions that are coming up, and we're focusing on, you know, what we should be doing, a successful cannabis marketplace that people feel that they can go to get safe cannabis to consume.
Yeah. And I mean, that's public trust, right? Like, what are the unintended undercurrent of what seems to have at least been the first bit of the show is this idea of like the regulated business, if they have trust in the stability of it, that they trust that the rules are good, that they trust that they're going to get a fair deal from regulators, they will, their compliance rates will increase, right? But if there is not trust, then people will blow stuff off, right? And that trust is built by saying, hey, we're not here to throw the book at you. I mean, if you're selling to kids, if you're crossing the line of the North Star problems, like, for sure. But like on this other stuff, we're going to send you a notice of deficiency. If it's bigger, we're going to send you a letter of concern being like, hey, we're starting to get a little concerned about what you guys got going on over there. Like, fix it. But those things are not also the sword of Damocles that's hanging over your head forever, or it's not being shared and talked about as a problem to resolve. Instead, you're taking a very kind of problem solving, proactive, I don't want to say business friendly, because that might not be right, but it is a solution oriented approach, and one that treats businesses with respect, right? And not like this is some game of cat and mouse that I think can be very corrosive. So you come into this organization, you come into this situation where you feel like there was a big problem in 2019 in terms of kind of working to build back that trust. What were some of the initiatives that you undertook early on that we'll get to kind of my favorite topic in a minute, but what were some of the initiatives that maybe can be framed as you can't build until you fix the foundation? And so you took on a series of initiatives to kind of reform the foundation. How did you go about doing that as you kind of embarked on this new agency approach?
Sure. I mean, it was pretty easy for us. We started at square one. I mean, it was like, get everybody in a room. We start with the mission statement. We start with guiding principles. I mean, really build it from scratch. And we do it openly, transparently. I mean, accountability is everything for us, because that was also a lot of the rub of the last oversight body, a lot of the accusations, right, that everything was done behind closed doors and done through relationships. And so we weren't going to go through that. And we didn't need to go through that. There was no point, right? We're there. We get to build it. We get to start fresh. And so, you know, accountability and transparency were our calling cards. So we developed a new mission. We got buy-in from some of the staff that we inherited. We got, frankly, got rid of some of the staff that this wasn't the place for them, right? We needed to build a new culture here. And so that's where we started, really from square one. We started for about 6 or 7 months before we even had the first managing board members, right? So we have a part-time managing board. As executive director, I manage all, you know, all day-to-day activities of oversight. And then once a month, we have a managing board meets that is the final kind of decision maker on licensing or discipline. And we had some great appointments early on to that board, a former Supreme Court, you know, state Supreme Court Chief Justice, a former gaming regulator, longest serving gaming regulator in the state of Nevada. So we brought in expertise. They were non-political appointments. They brought, you know, immediate integrity to the entire process. And then again, we started with the regulatory framework. We made the tweaks where we needed. And by the way, Jordan, I mean, you know, as you mentioned, we had a great framework. And I got to tell you, you know, I say scratch, and that was the agency, but we did start with a very, very comprehensive and what I think was a very successful regulatory framework. And so we at least were able to inherit that. Obviously, retooled it a little bit. We added some regulations to it that matched the new public policy of the state. But we had a great foundation. We obviously took a lot from Colorado in those early days, which was great, and then kind of put our own spin on it. And so from that point, like I said, we came out and we wanted to make sure that the public knew that you know, cannabis was being regulated appropriately, correctly, product was going to be safe, and that, again, we're going to establish and ensure that the cannabis industry is going to be an economic driver in the state. It already was. It was moving that way, but we wanted to obviously protect that, because while it's a new industry and there's employees, there's also tax revenue, which is a component of every ballot initiative that's out there, right? We're going to generate appropriate revenue to the state. And so what is our role in protecting that, fostering that, and also ensuring that the foundation we do build is a brick by brick, and we're not just buying a house. Jordan, we're building a house, and that was really our approach.
Yeah, and maybe building a house that has stability, right? Like not a fly by night, like this thing's going to fall down in the biggest, you know, in the first big windstorm or big, you know, big thunderstorm that's going to roll through, right? Because as you noted, you know, cannabis policy reform is a social justice issue. It's a criminal justice issue. It's a civil rights issue. It's an individual liberties and freedoms issue. But it is also an economic issue, right? And it is an economic issue for states. And, you know, Governor Polis on our end has come out repeatedly and said, you know, he wants Colorado to be a center of innovation for cannabis businesses. He wants us to be a hub of investment and for people to want to do business here and to bring businesses here. I'm sure that is true for many, many states. But in a highly regulated industry, if that's what you want, you only get it through good fair, even-handed, solid regulation. You get that through public trust. If the public has trust that the regulatory agency is going to do a good job, the general public, I mean, you are going to get the buy-in to help build that industry. And if you get the industry's buy-in that you are a fair dealer, that you have good regulations, that you're not overly abusive or anything else like that, you will see businesses want to site there. You will see investment in your state. And that's really important, not just for tax revenue, but jobs, right? Because at the end of the day, taxes are really important, but like the true like North Star of helping and giving someone a hand up in America is not the government. It is getting them a job, giving them an ability to provide for their family. And so taking that lens of saying, hey, we're not compromising on public health and safety, but we also want to foster a good business environment, that has significant benefits to the state because there's lots of people who now have real jobs that have good benefits, that pay well, that can take care of their family, that pay taxes or generate tax revenue that can be used for programs to support other people. But it all boils down to that regulatory foundation. None of that good stuff happens without good regulation, because regulation works.
Absolutely. And there's a way to do that, you know, not blindly, right? Not just making a decision in an office that, hey, you know, this seems like the right thing to do, or I'm just going to, you know, be pro-business for the next year and anything is good with me. I'm going to pass it, right? There's a way to do it openly. Something that we do a lot is a petition process. Even when they make sense to us, it's like, come in front of the board, talk about why you don't need two delivery drivers in the same vehicle at all times, right? And let's talk through it, make a presentation, and then let's make a decision. Let's not sit on it. Let's not research it if we don't need to. But if it makes sense, it doesn't sacrifice safety, it's going to help your bottom line, right? Let's make the decision, but we're going to make it in public so everybody understands what it was, what the problem was, what a potential solution is. Everybody has an opportunity to say their piece, but then we move. And I think that last piece is critical, right? You move, right? You want flexibility, you build it in. What good is building flexibility in if you're not willing to sit down and make the kind of tweaks and changes immediately? And I think we've done a pretty good job of doing that here and continue to do that.
Yeah, because on the front end, you have to give people an opportunity to be heard. If you want to build public trust, if you want to get buy-in, they have to feel like they have a chance to be heard. If they don't feel like they have a chance to be heard, you've lost them before you've even started the game. But then if you string them out or make decisions in private, you may have gotten them, you've started the process for public trust and buy-in, but you have lost them by not giving them a quick decision or a transparent decision, right? The key is to give them an opportunity to be heard and then make that decision as quickly as, I mean, government is, a lot of my day is explaining to private sector people that government moves slowly and differently than the private sector, but, you know, moving quickly in terms of government and having a transparent resolution. So someone felt like they were heard, but not just you had a chance to speak, but we really listened to you. We understand why this is important. We have made a decision to agree or disagree with you, right? Your job is not to agree with everything that everyone comes forward with. I think what you owe them is a chance to be heard and a fair shake, right? Like, I'm going to really listen to what you have to say. I'm then going to make a decision, and I'm going to do that in a reasonable time frame, and I'm going to give some transparency as to why, right? And I think that if people are still complaining that you didn't agree with them all the time, then they miss the boat, right? Like, your job is not to agree with them all the time, but to run a good agency, you do have to give them an opportunity to be heard and to transparency. And then you build that trust, right? So when you build trust, when you kind of create stability, reduce volatility, get buy-in from the public, get the basic foundation under control, then you get to do some really cool, excited, creative stuff, right? And so I think that that's an important part of the story, because everybody likes to do fun, creative stuff. But what I find is that people don't want to do the due diligence, the homework, the basics to give them the opportunity to do the creative stuff. And that this is one of those moments where you did a lot of that kind of nitty gritty work, but it really paid off and gave you an opportunity to do something dynamic and creative, which for me, dynamic and creative and exciting in cannabis policy these days likely means typically only one thing, and that is cannabis hospitality, the next frontier of transitioning from prohibition to treating cannabis like it should be regulated and treating cannabis consumers like every other citizen. And so you guys have spent a lot of time working on this. And so I do want to talk about what it looks like and what's happening now, but we wouldn't be a good wonky nerdy podcast if we didn't get into government process. So if you are excited about government process and good process, you should probably listen to the next little bit of the podcast. If you're like, dear God, I can't listen to anything about government podcasts, you might want to fast forward a little bit. But I do really want to talk about the process, because once you build that trust, you maintain that trust by having a really good process. So cannabis hospitality is a thing. You guys want to explore what that should look like. What is the process that you used to get from, hey, this might be something we look at, to shortly and probably even before this podcast airs, potentially businesses opening, cannabis hospitality businesses opening in Nevada?
Yeah, I think it's going to be a fairly exciting time in the state and in Nevada, and certainly with the backdrop of Las Vegas, you know, the entertainment capital of the world. You know, this is probably the place to launch a kind of comprehensive consumption lounge program like we've embarked on. But to take you back, so this is the same legislature in 2019 that created the CCB because they felt that the industry and the oversight body was out of control. So 2 years later, they felt good about it. A sponsor of consumption lounges, which was a topic that was talked about but wasn't authorized, pushed forth legislation. The chair of the judiciary at the time, he's now the speaker, Steve Yeager. We had a lot of great conversations. He was going to push it forward, and he did. And essentially, obviously, with some components like social equity included, essentially that legislation was like, we are hereby authorizing consumption lounges, public consumption in these lounges. CCB, figure it out. We trust you. You figure out the program and you launch it. And, you know, it was certainly a compliment to us, but also like, here we go, right? It's time to, it's time to work.
Be careful what you wish for, right? Because you're like, I did such a good job. Now you trust me so much. You're going to give me any direction? Nah, figure it out.
Yeah. And I mean, even like social equity, right? It's a component of it, but the CCB will figure out what the definition of that is. I mean, so a lot of it, but again, we, you know, those were conversations that happened. It wasn't, it wasn't a surprise. And honestly, Jordan, it was my choice, or that would be my choice, right? So that we didn't have statutory language. I mean, that's the worst kind of policy when you're constrained with, you know, statutory language that a lot of times is conflicting and you're stuck in the middle, and that's a disaster. So I'd much rather do this through regulation, which they agreed with. And so,
and regulation gives you flexibility. You talked about flexibility before, right? Regulation gives you flexibility. You know, this is an evolving issue. If a statute is very prescriptive, you're stuck. It's much harder to pass a bill. So you're in a good spot. I mean, I agree. It means you got a lot of work, but, you know, I think that's probably preferable to some of the other approaches that we've seen where we have very, you know, specific and dictatorial statutes.
Right. And kudos to the legislature at the time. I mean, that's ceding control too, right? If you're not dictating all the parameters, that's them ceding control to a state agency. And so there were two things that were very important on the front end. And that was making sure that we had appropriate resources. So we almost increased our staff by 50%, and then being very forthright and forthcoming on the time frame. That bill passed and was signed in June, and there were people who wanted consumption lounges open by October, which is great. There was a great enthusiasm around it, but that wasn't going to be a reality. And we talked about government is not really known for being fast and efficient, sure, but I knew we were going to have to take the appropriate time to ensure the success of this consumption lounge program. But we weren't going to sit on our hands, right? There was going to be movement. And so I made it clear that this was going to be a year plus process to put the right framework in place. But we talk about foundation, it would have a strong foundation behind it. And talking about that on the front end really helped us throughout the process not feel like we were under the gun. Again, the legislature heard us. They agreed. They didn't set some arbitrary deadline, which a lot of times happens in statute when you put these programs in place. And that kind of sometimes leads to bad policy or bad regulation because you're under the gun and you're rushing. And we actually see that a lot in cannabis, right? When a ballot initiative happens, they say, oh, this is great. You have 6 months to launch an adult use market. And so we see a lot of the challenges that other states face.
Yeah, I government processes take a long time because they should sometimes. Sometimes it's not efficient. Sometimes it's literally that government should take longer. And like private sector people are like, but I want it to happen faster. Citizens are like, want it to happen faster. And sometimes when you're talking about like the turnaround time on an application, and that's really just a bandwidth issue and complexity of regulation issue, like fine, that's one thing. But if you're designing a new regulatory architecture, that should take time. That is a process that needs time for people to talk, for ideas to marinate, for changes to be made, for you to be iterative so that you have that good foundation. So, you know, I think it's important to note, like, yeah, people wanted it to open right away, but it is in everyone's benefit to be somewhat thoughtful and methodical about the time frame as well, because that is how you end up with good policy, and you're not back changing the rules on someone who just launched their business 6 months ago. And they're like, actually, we got to change a whole bunch of stuff, which is hard.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And so we set out on about what ended up being almost a 12 to 15 month process. I think in the first year, we had over 15 public meetings, was able to create some subcommittees around public health and public safety and social equity. We brought in experts from different states that have had, you know, different kind of iterations of social consumption here and there, Colorado, California, as well. I got to put some of the bill sponsors on some of the subcommittees just to ensure we had buy-in from all of the stakeholders on the process. That was extremely helpful as part of it. And we ended up and the goal was to finish it, you know, at least the framework by the end of the year. And so then we moved with the full rules and regulations and regulatory framework, had a number of meetings on that to make sure everybody got to say their piece. Obviously, when you're talking about social consumption, you've got local governments play a huge role in that. You've got law enforcement and the anxieties that law enforcement had, deservedly so, around social consumption, right? And so making sure we had the space to bring all of those voices in, again, knowing that that is part of the foundation. So when we do launch, there's no coming in after the fact, right? And saying, I can't believe that happened. I can't believe you did that. I told you I was right. You had the ample opportunity to come in and be a part of the process, and we invited you and brought you in. And so that was all kind of the strategy behind that 12 to 15 months. We ended it. I think we've got a great framework in place. We finished it by the end of 2022. And then in December, we did our first licensing round for consumption lounges, both for dispensaries who could open up consumption lounges attached to their dispensary, and for the first time, standalone consumption lounges. These are individuals that have not been in the industry. First time in Nevada history that we did a licensing round for people that were not already in the industry, obviously outside purchases and acquisitions, right? And then as well, you know, social equity licensees for the first time in Nevada also had a carve out on the consumption lounges. And so here we are in November. We've spent the majority of this year approving a handful of licenses to move forward. They have to obviously go find, you know, building space, get the local government approvals, build out their facilities. It's an unknown market. There is no blueprint anywhere. We see many business plans and projections, but nobody really knows until we open it up. We don't know how successful it's going to be, which is very exciting, but there's obviously a lot of interest. People are moving forward. And yeah, like you said, Jordan, by the time this airs, we may have one or two lounges open, but they may, and they will definitely open shortly thereafter. And then we're going to see them in practice. So it's a very interesting, exciting time to see what happens with this new sector, like you said, the new frontier of the legal cannabis industry.
And so you were able to bring kind of all of these different experts together. It sounds like, I mean, this was maybe one of the most involved processes we've seen around cannabis hospitality. Like, there are some states that have moved forward, you know, in terms of having some, like in Colorado, we passed a bill for cannabis hospitality in 2019. I think there's a small number of them operating in the state programs, a complete disaster, disaster in the sense of it's not taking root. I guess there's bigger disasters of like problems with public health and safety and negative outcomes. We're not having that either. We just are kind of not having much of anything. I think the effort on your end was to really invest more time in what is this going to look like, getting law enforcement right, public buy-in. Law enforcement is a lot easier for law enforcement to complain about how something works if you don't bring them to the table. But if you bring them to the table and say, what are you concerned about? What do you care about? What is you're worried about? They're worried about roadside safety. Okay, well, let's talk about that, right? People are consuming cannabis. That's going to happen. We don't want them to drive while they're high. What can we do about that? How do we problem solve for that? And then you get their ideas. They feel like they've been heard. You can adopt policies to help mitigate the things they're worried about. And then everyone gets bought in, right? Because they've had this opportunity to be heard. Their concerns have been respected and appreciated. and put together into a comprehensive program that can address this. What would you say, in looking back, looking at the rules now, what's about to come out, what are maybe a couple of the more interesting policy decisions that you had to make, or kind of innovative ways you're thinking about this, whether it's Clean Indoor Air Act stuff, which is interesting, or driving while high, which is obviously always a significant concern, especially for literally everybody who doesn't want to have a problem on the roads. Kind of those kinds of things. Like, where were the most interesting things where you got to make a real decision about how to solve a problem?
Yeah, and there's a few of them, and I will go back a little bit and say, you know, Steve Yeager was the bill sponsor. You know, while they kicked it to the CCB to figure out the rules and regulations, the flexibility portion of it. So what was clear is that this was going to allow for many different types of consumption and different kinds of ideas. I mean, it was meant to be a consumption lounge program that would be successful and innovative and allow entrepreneurs to come in and really push the limits and the boundaries on what a consumption lounge would look like, right? So there was no issue that were you going to be able to have combustibles inside a cannabis consumption lounge, right? With the Clean Indoor Air Act issues, right? That was discussed and it was put in the record, right? So that was helpful for us too, but we still had to figure out what that looked like. And yes, driving, you know, under the influence, poly substance use, right? And again, we looked at that and we looked at what should be required in the rules and regulations. And we ended up being, you know, landing on mitigation plans that you have to have on record. We're not going to tell you you have to have a no-toe policy at your facility, but we're going to identify that. That's going to be part of our rulemaking process. It's going to be on the record. So, you know, at least it was discussed, but it's going to be on you as the licensee to make sure you have components of your consumption labs that are going to protect against that, right? But we're not going to overstep and demand and mandate that you have some of those things. Foodstuffs, Jordan, I mean, like, so creating infused food, that has the potential on the culinary side, right, to open up, you know, a whole nother subsector.
And I think it's important to differentiate, right? We're not talking about the consumption of manufactured edible products at a hospitality establishment, which is one interesting area of policy and conversation. But on-site infusion is what we refer to it as. That was my big thing in 2019 when we passed the bill, and the regulatory agency at the time was like, hey man, can we just do this one step at a time? Can we put in the bill that you can't do on-site infusions? Let's get this program rolling. Let's get it stable. And then once that happens, we'll have a conversation about doing on-site infusion, because as you noted, culinary, very interesting opportunities there. But again, back to something else you said, we don't have flexibility in statute. So the fact that our program is not really going anywhere, if we thought that that would be a good idea or something to add to give the program more viability, we'd actually have to run a bill to change it, which would be very challenging. Whereas you could say, hey, initially, we're not going to allow that. Maybe you did, and we'll talk about it. But like, the flexibility of making that decision or changing that decision without going to the legislature is really important on kind of some of these like wonkier issues, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, again, our health districts, you know, obviously they had huge concerns. This is something very, very new for them. And when things are new, you know, there's anxiety around it, right? Change is hard. But receiving that, making sure they're a part of it. But then in the regulations, it's not like you can go make whatever food you want, Jordan, and we have no oversight whatsoever. That's not the case at all. I mean, our regulations say you can go down this path. We're going to go down it with you, and you're going to need our approval at the end of the day. However, it's clear that this is going to be a component, and we're here to make it a reality, right, in a safe and effective way. But it exists, and you can now go down that path. And so we felt like, you know, we didn't sacrifice our ability to regulate it appropriately and have health and safety in mind. But we're not, you know, we're not restricting what you're going to be able to do with these particular lounges around that. And then, you know, finally,
that was the goal from the legislature, though, right? Like, the legislature's goal was, we want a world class, dynamic cannabis hospitality environment where entrepreneurs can be creative and try all different kinds of things to see how they're going to be successful. So to come out and say this business model is just out of bounds, like, that's not a good idea, because that's not going to lead to the goal of a world-class environment. But to say, hey, we're also not going to let you go willy-nilly and do whatever you want and do things that are unsafe. We're going to partner with you, walk down this road, and figure out how we can make sure you can be creative and entrepreneurial in a safe manner, right? And I think a lot of those conversations I had were like, well, how do we know it's going to be dosed correctly, Jordan? And I'm like, because they're chefs. Like, how do you know that when you go to a restaurant and you have an allergy that they're not going to give you something that you're allergic to? Like, that's their job. That's what they do. Doesn't mean that we don't have a food department or we don't have a public health department that's not like, there's a sign that you have to wash your hands after you go to the bathroom for a reason at restaurants, right? Like, we don't let people do whatever that we want. We try to find a way to let them do what they want, but make sure they're doing it safely. Those are two very different approaches.
Yeah. And again, knowing, understanding, preparing, posturing to make tweaks on day one, right? We don't know what we don't know. We're going to go down the path. We're going to allow that, but we're also going to make sure that we're able to tweak the knobs where we need to on day one. And again, communicating that, right? So everybody is on the same page. We all want this to be a successful part. It was mandated by the legislature. It's in state law. We all want it to be successful. We're all not here working for it not to be successful. And so that's part of it. And finally, and you and I had a conversation about it, was air ventilation, right? And really kind of coming to terms with a lot of really great health experts on my staff, right? And you know, coming to terms and making sure the board knew and having the conversations around, like, our job is not to make sure that air is completely 100% safe. That's not a reality if the legislature authorized lighting up a joint in a consumption lounge, right? And so that's not our decision. Our decision now is, how do we put this in the best place or the best position to be a safe environment, to have employees have an ability to take a step out of a smoking room if they so choose, have kind of PPE that they need. But again, allowing flexibility for this program to succeed without ensuring or mandating that they invest $3 million, right? I'm making that number up, into a air ventilation system that is so complex, right? That every single air particle is out of there and it's the cleanest air that you've ever seen, right? Like, that's not realistic. Now, again, kind of back to my prior point, we went down that path. We had air experts and we talked about it. It's in our regulations what we consider to be an appropriate air ventilation system that has those protections in it. But the kicker is, at the end, we allow for flexibility for you as a potential consumption lounge licensee or applicant to come up with an alternative plan, to hire a professional engineer, to say, hey, listen, this is my space. This is what it looks like. I hired an engineer to come in here. They said I could accomplish X, Y, and Z utilizing this, which is different than it's in the regulations. And so they can come in front of the board and apply for an exemption to our requirements. It's already been exercised and it was approved. So the system has already worked here in Nevada. And again, I think it's a great example of, listen, we want what's best. We want to protect health and safety, but we also have a mandate to put a program in place that's going to succeed. And, you know, if you're talking about 30 complete air changes or 50 complete air changes when it's 120 degrees in the Las Vegas summer, like, we knew there was going to be some impediments to this, but building in, again, that flexibility, that ability to have the discussions and move to alternative routes or pivot where we needed to is built in. It's baked into the regulations.
Yeah. And you said $3 million, like, maybe you're being a little hyperbolic. Like, I don't think you're being as, I mean, like, what, there's a relatively, you know, reasonably sized facility that's certainly not a big facility by Vegas standards by any means, that is trying to get off the ground here in Denver. And they're looking at north of $500,000 just for air filtration. Put another way, how are you ever going to get these things open? Like the math has to close on a business. Like, it just doesn't, like, everything else is like, you could have all the other great things in the world. If the math doesn't close, the math doesn't close. And I think, but you did two critical things to help make sure that these businesses are viable, that they can get enough investment in the door to get their doors open. One, you looked at it and set an air filtration standard in regulation on your own without the goal of, like, being hospital air. And that's really important, because right now, the air filtration standards and requirements that you would default to, but for adopting your own standard, would be the International Building Code. And those standards are incredibly high and incredibly strict. And that's what's causing this massive cost, right? So, you know, other jurisdictions that have moved forward with this have just defaulted to the International Building Code, and that is preventing people from ever getting their doors open. You took a more rational approach of saying, hey, wait a minute, these are places where people are smoking weed. Like, the people going into them for work and the people going in there to hang out know that people are going to be smoking weed. Doesn't mean we don't want to try to make the air safer, but like, the notion that this is going to be like the air in a hospital is probably not necessary either. And so you struck a real balance in rule. And I think that that's really important, because if you hadn't, you'd be running into a lot of problems like we've been running into. Secondly, you said, hey, if you got another plan or a better idea, like, let's talk about it, right? And that does two things, actually. One, it lets people come forward and you try to problem solve and you have that flexibility you were talking about, but it actually encourages people to be innovative, right? If you hadn't had that flexibility in there, a business would have no reason to be innovative and think outside the box. So by creating this flexibility, yes, you kind of allow the regulatory agency to learn and work with folks, but you're saying, hey, you do have the opportunity to be innovative here. In Colorado, the businesses don't even have an opportunity to be innovative, so why would they bother, right? You're encouraging innovation. So you're not only problem solving, but you're actually encouraging entrepreneurs to be innovative, which is what we need to do, right? Those are the people who are innovators. They're the entrepreneurs. And it doesn't mean every idea is a good idea. It doesn't mean you're going to approve them. But I'd rather have a system that says, we are encouraging you to be innovative. We still might say no, but we want you to think outside the box in this scenario. And that's a really important value to have too. So, you know, it's kind of like a double kudos, right? Where yes, you had a really good, you took the work to do the air filtration standard of your own, but you also let this flexibility, and that has huge benefits when you think about 10 years out, what this program is going to look like.
And think about how it's making our staff, so our regulators, better as well, as we learn about these systems, right? It's not just one system we learn about. People are bringing new ideas, new systems to us, you know, and we get to learn about them. We get to know the ins and outs, and that's going to help us for future approvals. So everybody, you know, gets better through a process like that. I'm very proud of the entire lounge process, but that particular one as well. And you know, I think it's something we'll certainly, you know, this body will likely seek to replicate in future promulgation efforts around different programs.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's almost like a really good example of the approach you've taken in other areas too, right? It's been successful, it'll be done more, but it's also based on this conversation, I think, consistent with the other ways you've looked at things, right? It's just a really good way to illustrate kind of that approach. So we've been on for a while. Appreciate the time. Just to wrap up, you know, you are going through kind of a life transition. That transition will likely have occurred to some extent by the time folks are hearing this. And very excited to kind of continue the conversation, catch up when I come out there and hear about what adventures lie ahead for you. But Your previous adventures were not just exclusive to the state of Nevada. You had a really important role in a really amazing organization, CANRA, that allows you to kind of source ideas from colleagues, meet with amazing regulators in other states, and also gives you an opportunity to kind of both crowdsource ideas internally, but also share your perspective on how you've improved things in Nevada externally. So, you know, what is your how do you feel about your time at CANRA? You know, why, you know, I mean, obviously, I think it's really important, but why do you feel like it's so valuable? And maybe kind of share some perspective on that, because I really think that it's going to make everything better in cannabis policy in the long run, having this organization there.
No, I agree with you. And I know you've had Jillian Schauer, executive director, on. I know you've had Adria Berry from Oklahoma, and they've all talked about it. But again, all of that underscores how important an association like CANRA has been. And I was lucky enough to be in fairly, you know, at the beginning and help found it. I just ended my term as president of CANRA in July of this year. And I can't say enough. And I think all the regulators would gush about CANRA because, I mean, especially in this industry, I mean, you can get so siloed in your state and get so protected and not see the bigger picture. And CANRA really allows chief regulators to step out and look at best practices, avoid mistakes, copy successes. And so this association has grown tremendously from the beginning. And I think it'll continue to grow. As you know, it's international now with Canada, with more countries, you know, potentially coming on online. So just a great place. And, you know, there's no dog in the fight other than making sure we have sound policy and regulation. And in an industry like this, in an industry like the hemp industry, there's a lot of different voices. There's a lot of misinformation out there. CANRA, I think, really takes that spot of being a source of truth for legislators, stakeholders, members of the association. And I'm proud of it. I'm proud of every single member. You know, Jordan, Jillian talked about, I think I didn't hear her whole podcast, but you know, how difficult this job is and how, you know, doing the right thing usually means you've upset everybody just a little bit. CANRA, you know, makes it worth it. And, you know, something that I wanted to focus on as president was expanding our federal footprint because of what's happening and at the federal level, because there is so much churning, making sure that CANRA's got a voice and a seat at that table is critical. It's going to ensure that policy, nothing ensures policy is sound, but you know what, it ensures that a sound voice, in my opinion, is going to be a part of the conversation where it potentially hasn't before. And I'm very proud of that work, proud of this association. And as far as me, you know, not going anywhere anytime soon. There's just too much moving at the federal level.
Yeah. And I mean, using the letter you guys sent out about intoxicating hemp as like a really good example of a place for CANRA where, you know, CANRA doesn't really have a dog in the fight, but it's a really complicated issue that folks don't totally understand. And I think we're getting to a point of more kind of collective understanding, but especially even months ago when that letter came out, I don't think there was. And I thought there was just a very, not like, you know, it certainly had a little bit of a bent to it, but it was a bit of like, these are the facts on the ground. Like, what are we going to do about it, guys? Because like, whatever it is, like, this ain't good. Right. The stat, like, so we got to, you know, we got to figure it out. Like, this is clearly an issue. It was not intended. What is the solution? And it didn't say, it didn't close off kind of varying options of solutions. It was just saying, hey, we got to do something here, because if not, you know, we got some public health and safety problems. Like, can you sell this stuff to kids? And like, if it's not being regulated by anybody, then who's stopping you from selling it to kids? And, you know, websites that just say, oh, you know, just affirm that you're of age in the appropriate age of consent in the state you're buying this in. It's like maybe not the level of age gating that we were hoping for in a legalized and regulated cannabis market. Maybe a little bit more than self-affirming you're of age in the state that you're supposed to be in. And that, you know, saying that, it's not saying, hey, we need to do this or that. It's just saying, hey, the current situation of doing nothing isn't working, right? And I think that was a really good and important moment for CANRA, where you guys did dive into a really thorny, complicated issue. You did it clearly. You did it judiciously. You stayed in, you know, kind of the appropriate lane of a regulator. But it was also something that I hope was taken very seriously by everybody involved, because it is a lot of experts coming together and saying, and pointing their finger and saying, hey, we got to work on this. Like, we're not saying it has to be like this or it has to be like that, but we got to work on this one. And I think CANRA has that opportunity to not only crowdsource ideas, not to be this kind of conduit of information between regulators, but also giving the regulators an ability to speak with one voice to point out areas for improvement in policy. And that's a huge value too.
It wasn't our way or the highway, right? It was a flag that was planted where, frankly, there wasn't one planted before. And whether, you know, you agree with some of it, all of it, none of it, that's fine, right? But these are real world examples. You can't argue that it wasn't factual, right? And that it didn't have, you know, an addendum that had countless numbers of real world examples. And again, in a world like this, because we're still evolving, there's so much maturing left in the cannabis industry and the hemp industry. You know, that is truth. And in a time where there's a lot of misinformation out there, I think CANRA, its potential is just limitless in this space.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think it's just a great place to close, because, you know, it really articulates, you know, kind of almost from the beginning of your journey that we talked about, through all the work that you did in Nevada and how that work is important. Right. Because another one of the great things that CANRA can do with our unintended theme is build trust. Right. That the regulators are working to build best practices. The regulators are working to learn from each other. As a member of industry, that's very comforting to me, right? That because you guys don't have to do that, right? Like, there's no law, there's no rule that says very busy, overworked cannabis regulatory agencies need to also invest time in building a national organization to share best practices, to put out statements like you did on these issues. Like, you don't have to do that. That is a purely voluntary action. And it is awesome, as someone who's worked in this industry for a long time, to see our regulators wanting to do that. And that gives me tremendous trust that things will continue to get better, right? And that's all policy is this quest for improvement over time. And Canra, I think, is a huge example of all of those things. And I really appreciate everything that you and everyone else that's been involved in leadership roles and or just participating, because I really do think it is that beautiful sharing of ideas. And all of the experience I've had with Canra have been not only tremendously positive, but really, like, you know, everyone is trying to get together to talk through things and make things better. That's a huge, huge value add. And it's not necessarily the most common thing in the world these days. So, you know, kudos to that. And obviously love hearing about the cannabis hospitality program. I think tremendous work on that front. Can't wait to learn more, see how things play out, see what options are there. And of course, what we can all learn from each other, what we can learn as we try to get our program moving here in Colorado and try to understand the approaches that you took. And if we've got some really good, successful ideas about what's worked here, excited to share those back to Nevada. And so, you know, excited to hear about what the future holds and kind of see how all this stuff plays out. You've done a lot of great work, and now we kind of get to see some of the trees grow from the seeds that you've planted over the last several years.
Well, thanks, Jordan. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me. And I'll see you, I think, in a few days in Las Vegas.
Yep. You get the great pleasure of everyone in the cannabis world, or at least a lot of us, coming out to your town. We've had those days back in Denver, but it's been a minute. So maybe one day in the future, we'll get everyone back here again. So yeah, thank you so much. I really appreciate you taking the time. I know you've got a busy day, so it means a lot that you carve out so much time to have a little fun and dork out about all of this stuff. And look forward to hearing about what's next and seeing you in person soon. And with that, we'll just say stay nerdy, everybody.